The Guardian.
Welcome to The Guardian Long Read, showcasing the best long-form journalism covering culture, politics and new thinking. For the text version of this and all our long reads, go to theguardian.com/longread.
This audio long read contains strong language.
Why we need to take bad sex more seriously. Consent has been portrayed as the cure for all the ills of our sexual culture. But what if the injunction to know what you want is another form of coercion? By Catherine Angel. Read by Lucy Scott and produced by Esther Opoku-Jenny. Sometime in the early 2010s, the porn actor James Dean made a film with a fan whom he called Girl X. He would do this now and then. Fans would write to him, wanting to have sex with him, or he would put out a call to do a scene with James Dean, and the results would go up on his website. In an interview in May 2017, only a few months before the media would be overwhelmed with discussions of assault and harassment by Harvey Weinstein and others, and only 2 years after Dean himself was accused of, but not charged with, multiple assaults, which he denied, he said, "I have a Do a Scene with James Dean contest where women can submit an application and then, after a very long talk and months of me saying, you know, everyone's going to find out, it's going to affect your future, and trying to talk them out of it, kind of, then we shoot a scene." Little of the Girl X video actually involves sex. It is mostly a long, flirtatious, fraught conversation, which circles repeatedly back to whether or not they are, in fact, going to do this. Have sex, film it, and put it online. Girl X hesitates. She moves between playfulness and retreat. She is game, then agonized. She lurches ahead, then stalls. She is torn, reflective, and self-questioning. She thinks her dilemmas out loud, and Dean tries to follow along. She presumably wants to do a scene with James Dean, but when he opens the door to her, she appears to lose some nerve. She walks into the apartment, dressed in PVC leggings, a buttoned-up silk cream blouse with black detail. Our gaze is behind the camera, with Dean filming her, and paces around in agitation, laughing a high-pitched, nervous laugh, saying, "Oh my God, oh my God." He occasionally brings the camera up to her face. She turns away. He teases her. "You're a college girl, you're smart and shit." As they move back and forth in the kitchen, with its gleaming central island, in the corridor, with its bright white dado rails and deep red walls. She's skittish, nervous. "I can't even look at you." Moving away, moving in. She sits down at a shiny chrome table on a white bench. They discuss a contract. The footage fades out. We are not privy to the details. It fades back in, and she takes a selfie. She is about to sign. But then she stops and says, "What am I doing with my life? What the fuck am I doing with my life?" She can back out at any stage, he says. They can rip the contract up. More fading in and out. We see her sign. "We can figure out a stage name later," he says, "unless you just want to be Girl X." "I don't know," she says in a reluctant drawl. "I have no idea. I've never done this." When Girl X expresses her ambivalence, "I want to have sex with you," she says, "but I don't know if I want to show the world." He is receptive. "You don't want to be slut-shamed," he says. She carries on. "Like," she says, adopting a blokey voice, "I saw you fuck him, why don't you fuck me?" This is not an entirely paranoid thought. One of the accused in the 2018 rugby rape trial in Northern Ireland, on entering the room after two other men performed sex acts on the plaintiff, asked her to have sex with him. And when she said no, he allegedly replied, "You fuck the others, why can't you fuck me?" A woman's presumed desire, even just once, for one man, makes her vulnerable. Her desire disqualifies her from protection. Once a woman is thought to have said yes to something, she can say no to nothing. We'll probably never know what happened after Dean turned the camera off, what happened in the breaks between the filmed sections, what was edited out, what conversations we didn't overhear, what sex we didn't see. We'll probably never know what Girl X made of the allegations against Dean, or whether there were things that day that made her uncomfortable, that caused her sorrow or anger. I don't know Girl X's story, but in the film, I see the painful and familiar experience of being pulled in different directions, of having to balance desire with risk, of having to pay attention to so much in the pursuit of pleasure. Women know that their sexual desire can remove protection from them and can be invoked as proof that violence wasn't, in fact, violence. She wanted it. Girl X shows us then that it is not only desire's expression, but its very existence that is either enabled or inhibited by the conditions in which it is met. How can we know what we want, when knowing what we want is something demanded of us and the source of punishment? No wonder Girl X has mixed feelings, is paralyzed by uncertainty. Dean understands none of the melancholic weight of sex for Girl X. He doesn't have to. Girl X, however, has grown up with impossible demands. She is living out the double bind in which women exist. That saying no may be difficult, but so too is saying yes. In 2017, the dam broke on allegations against Weinstein. Subsequently, the hashtag MeToo, a slogan originated by Tarana Burke in 2006 to draw attention to sexual violence against young women of color, spread on social media, galvanizing women to tell their stories of sexual assault. Widespread media coverage ensued in the following months, largely about abuses of power in the workplace. And in this environment, the act of speaking out about your experiences was taken as a self-evident and necessary good. I was glad of the coverage, and also dreaded it, having at times to rush to turn off the news and its relentless parade of grim stories. During hashtag MeToo's height, it sometimes felt that we were required to tell our stories. The accumulation of stories online, on Facebook, on Twitter, as well as in person, created a sense of pressure, of expectation. When will you tell yours? It was hard not to notice the collective appetite for these stories, an appetite couched in the language of concern and outrage, one that fit neatly with the belief that speaking the truth is a foundational axiomatic value for feminism. Hashtag MeToo not only validated women's speech, but risked making it a duty too. A mandatory display of one's feminist powers of self-realization, one's determination to refuse shame, and one's strength in speaking back to indignity. It also gratified a salacious hunger for stories of women's abuse and humiliation, though it did so selectively. When do we ask women to speak, and why? Who does this speaking serve? Who is asked to speak in the first place? And whose voices are listened to? Though any woman's allegation of sexual violence tends to encounter powerful resistance, wealthy white women's accounts were privileged during hashtag MeToo over those, for example, of young black women whose families had sought justice from the musician and sexual abuser R. Kelly for decades. He has denied the allegations against him. Studies show that black women reporting crimes of sexual violence are less likely to be believed than their white counterparts, with black girls seen as more adult-like and sexually knowing than their white peers, and that rape convictions relating to white victims lead to more serious outcomes than those relating to black women. Not all speech is equal. In recent years, two requirements have emerged for good sex: consent and self-knowledge. In the realm of sex, where the ideal, at least, of consent reigns supreme, women must speak out, and they must speak out about what they want. They must, then, also know what it is that they want. In what I'll call consent culture, the widespread rhetoric asserting that consent is the locus for transforming the ills of our sexual culture, women's speech about their desire is demanded and idealized, touted as a marker of progressive politics. "Know what you want and learn what your partner wants," urged a New York Times article in July 2018, promising that good sex happens where those two agendas meet. This rhetoric is not entirely new. Feminist campaigning has focused intensely on consent since the 90s, provoking in the process much agitated commentary. Rachel Kramer Bussell wrote more recently that, as women, it's our duty to ourselves and our partners to get more vocal about asking for what we want in bed, as well as sharing what we don't. Neither partner can afford to be passive and just wait to see how far the other person will go. This injunction to women to clearly know and speak their desire is framed as inherently liberatory, since it emphasizes women's capacity for and right to sexual pleasure. Progressive thought has long cast sexuality and pleasure as stand-ins for emancipation and liberation. It was precisely this that philosopher Michel Foucault was critiquing in 1976 in The Will to Knowledge, when he wrote that tomorrow sex will be good again. He was paraphrasing, sardonically, the stance of the countercultural sexual liberationists of the 60s and 70s, the Marxists, the revolutionaries, the Freudians, all those who believed that, in order to be liberated from the past's moralizing clutches, from a repressive Victorian past, we must finally tell the truth about sexuality. Foucault, in contrast, was skeptical of the way we ardently conjure away the present and appeal to the future, and argued that the stuffy Victorians were, in fact, intensely verbose about sex, even if that verbosity took the form of outlining pathologies, abnormalities, and aberrations. Not only did he revise the classic take on the Victorians as prudish, repressed, and wedded to silence, he also opposed the truisms that speaking out about sex amounts to liberation and that silence amounts to repression. "We must not think," he wrote, "that in saying yes to sex, one says no to power. Sex has been, and still is, prohibited and regulated in myriad ways, and women's sexuality in particular has been intensely constrained and policed. But consent, and its conceit of absolute clarity, risks placing the burden of good sexual interaction on women's behaviour, on what they want and on what they can know and say about their wants, on their ability to perform a confident sexual self in order to ensure that sex is mutually pleasurable and non-coercive. Woe betide she who does not know herself and speak that knowledge."
The Guardian. The Guardian.
In the late 80s and early 90s, when activists were seeking to change the public mindset, much media anxiety fixated on date rape or acquaintance rape. In 1993, the Sexual Offence Prevention Policy of Antioch College, a small US liberal arts institution, caused a furore. Written by female students dismayed to find out about rapes on a campus that prided itself on a progressive inclusivity, the policy stated that consent means verbally asking and verbally giving or denying consent for all levels of sexual behaviour. Consent had to be ongoing, and it was required regardless of the relationship between partners, regardless of previous sexual history or current activity. It could not, moreover, be given by someone who was intoxicated, unconscious, or asleep. Affirmative consent, increasingly written into laws and guidelines in recent years, holds that an absence of no is not a mark of consent, and recognizes that mutuality in sex is vital, and it has been extraordinarily divisive. In her book, The Morning After, Sex, Fear, and Feminism, published the same year as the Antioch Consent Policy, Katie Royfe argued that campus anti-rape campaigns projected a retrograde image of women that earlier feminists had succeeded in challenging, an image of women as vulnerable, wide-eyed, and timorous. This argument is still with us more than 20 years later. In Unwanted Advances, published in 2017, Laura Kipnis argued that affirmative consent guidelines have led to a culture of helplessness and victimhood on US university campuses. Royfe and Kipnis acknowledge the injustices and injuries that women encounter, but suggest that the solution to these lie in an idealized figure, the strong woman who can overcome it all, who can shrug off injuries and be tougher, be, frankly, less of a baby. Their critiques express perfectly, in other words, a confidence feminism, a feminism that places the onus on individual women and their assertiveness to overcome challenges and succeed in an unequal world. For these critics, grown women know how to shrug off the inevitable ups and downs of sex instead of crying assault. The trope of bad sex does important work in these conversations. Young women are encouraged, Kipnis argues, to deploy bureaucratic measures to remedy sexual ambivalences or awkward sexual experiences. For her and her peers, sex, even when it was bad, as it often was still educational. The idea that women should toughen up spans the political spectrum. Journalist Barry Weiss expressed a similar stance in her response to allegations against comedian Aziz Ansari in 2018. The allegations, published in an account on babe.net, provoked a furore, not least because its apparently rushed publication appears to have fallen short of normal standard journalistic standards, such as giving Ansari the right to reply. He later responded that the sex was, by all indications, completely consensual, but he took her words to heart. Grace, a pseudonym, told of feeling pressured into sex and of trying to give signals, verbal and non-verbal, of not being keen, which she alleges Ansari repeatedly failed to respect. For many, her story resonated as an example of an entitled and bullish man intent on acquiring sex, with little interest in the woman's pleasure, or even perhaps his own. For others, Grace was expecting Ansari to mind read and had failed to make clear either her own desires or her lack of enjoyment. She had failed to say yes enthusiastically and failed clearly to say no. There is, Weiss says, a useful term for what this woman experienced on her night with Mr. Ansari. It's called bad sex. It sucks. Weiss acknowledged that women are socialized to put men's desires before their own. But the solution to this problem is not, she claimed, to resent men for failing to understand their non-verbal cues. It is for women to be more verbal. It's to say, this is what turns me on. It's to say, I don't want to do that. Weiss admonished Grace in finger-wagging terms. If he pressures you to do something you don't want to do, use a four-letter word, stand up on your two legs and walk out his door. Similarly, Kipnis, on Jessa Crispin's Public Intellectual podcast, laments the fact that students can't get over 30 seconds or 15 minutes of bad sex. And Megan Daum, in The Guardian, wrote about a gap between many women's public support of hashtag MeToo and their private conversations. She writes, "Grow up, this is real life. I hear these same feminists say, there are strong intimations here of weak, wounded children versus confident grown women, and it's clear who we're supposed to want to be. This is a feminism in which it is every woman's duty to be assertive and confident, and in which, above all, one must not be seen to be wounded or injured. Indeed, the mere fact of feeling wounded is already a sign of weakness in this regime of individual capacity. What's more, bad sex is framed as an inevitable feature of the landscape, a brute, intractable fact around which women must work." Critics as different as Kipnis and Weiss can cast themselves as progressive by insisting that women can and should wield power and agency. And yet, in the airy gesturing towards the inevitability of youthful bad sex, they place an unequal burden on women to manage the risks of sex. They treat male contempt of women's pleasure and autonomy as an unchangeable fact, while treating women's manoeuvring around it as an imperative. And they reserve their scorn for women who fail to respond to it with an appropriate gutsiness. Back in 1993, the New York Times op-ed on the Antioch consent policy said that adolescence, and particularly the college years, are a time for experimentation, and experimentation means making mistakes. No policy can ever protect all young people from those awful mornings after, moments from which people learn. If people, as the New York Times put it, learn from bad sex, are the lessons men and women learn the same? It may well be that men learn that they can get away with not caring about a woman's pleasure, and that women learn they must prioritize male pleasure over their own. Who learns that their role is to acquire pleasure at whatever cost, and who learns that they must suffer sex's consequences alone? Consent is a given, the bare minimum for sex. And affirmative consent is, as sexuality scholar Joseph Fischel argues in Screw Consent, the least bad standard for sexual assault law compared with force, resistance, or non-consent standards. Requiring some minimal, not necessarily verbal, indication of positive agreement to sex shows a respect for a person's sexual autonomy and is a better measure than silence or resistance. But consent has a limited purview, and it is being asked to bear too great a burden to address problems it is not equipped to resolve. In their frustrations with consent, campus sexual culture, and hashtag MeToo, critics grope confusedly towards the insight that much sex that is consented to, even affirmatively consented to, is bad. Miserable, unpleasant, humiliating, one-sided, painful. Bad sex doesn't have to be assault in order for it to be frightening, shame-inducing, upsetting. They understand hazily that, as a legal concept, consent is unable to meaningfully get at how sex can be bad without being strictly assaultive. But they are as if paralysed by these insights and fail to probe, or convey much concern for, the dynamics that determine bad sex, sex that, because of its inequalities in pleasure, is of grave importance. Instead of resigning ourselves to the inevitability of bad sex and even romanticising it as merely youthful misadventure, we should take this bad sex seriously, subjecting it to sustained scrutiny. Bad sex emerges from gender norms in which women cannot be equal agents of sexual pursuit, and in which men are entitled to gratification at all costs. It occurs because of inadequacies and inequalities in sexual literacy, in access to sex education and sexual health services. It trades on unequal power dynamics between parties and on racialized notions of innocence and guilt. Bad sex is a political issue, one of inequality of access to pleasure and self-determination, and it is as a political issue that we should be examining it, rather than retreating into an individualizing, shoulder-shrugging criticism of young women who are using the tools available to them to address the pains of their sexual lives. The notion of not just affirmative but enthusiastic consent seeks to raise the bar further in sexual culture. We don't just want women to agree to sex initiated by men, but to want sex themselves, to feel excited about it, and to move in the world with their own desires and demands. Hence the swelling of affirmative consent into something more ambitious, into desire, pleasure, enthusiasm, positivity. The problem with consent is not that sex cannot and should never be contractual. The safety of sex workers relies precisely on the notion of a contract and the possibility of its violation in order that they can be understood as having been assaulted. Nor is it that consent is unsexy or unromantic. The problem instead is that an attachment to consent as the rubric for our thinking about sex, the problem with our being magnetized by it, as Fischel puts it, ignores a crucial aspect of being a person. That individuals do not bear equal relationships of power to one another. The attachment to consent, as the overarching framework for thinking about good and bad sex, amounts to holding on to the fantasy of liberalism, in which, as Emily A. Owens puts it, equality simply exists. Much sex that women consent to is unwanted, because they agree to it under duress, or out of a need to feed and clothe themselves and their family, or a need to remain safe. Women everywhere, every day, agree to sex because they feel they have no choice, because a man has them in his debt, because he has threatened them, because he can make them suffer by sacking them, evicting them, reporting their immigration status, or reporting them for an offence, such as sex work where it is criminalised. Many consent laws require consent to be non-coerced, but the reality is that women do agree to sex they would rather not have, out of a fear of the consequences. It's crucial, therefore, to maintain the distinction between consent and enthusiasm, precisely so that we can describe what is going on in these dynamics of unequal power. Unequal power relationships mean that consent itself cannot distinguish between good and bad sex, though it can, to a limited extent, distinguish sex from assault. Consent can be sexy, we are repeatedly told, an insistence that may well have emerged from critiques mocking it as a buzzkill. It should be wielded as part of the playful to and fro of sexual negotiation. It can, the website exojane.com advised, be worked into foreplay, turned into an integral part of sexual encounter as partners banter back and forth, tease, and check in with each other on what they are and aren't going to do. But this only works if we assume a certain kind of partner, one who is already fully committed to the complex autonomy of the other. It all depends on whether the woman feels she has the option to refuse, something that is not limited to the legal question of coercion. It depends, among other things, on whether the man she is with is able to hear a no, is able to negotiate without abusing his often greater physical and social power, is not abusing the knowledge that women rarely report assault and have the odds stacked against them if they do. Is he asking for sex while being open to the possibility that she may say no? Can he countenance a no, Will he flare up, ignore, persuade, cajole, bully, punish? Any model of consent can prove itself worthless if a man is not open to his sexual partner's no or her changing desires, and if he responds to either of these with a rage born of humiliation. A woman can still leave a sexual encounter justifiably feeling mistreated, while the man feels safe in the knowledge he acquired consent. He asked, she said yes. None of this means we should jettison consent. It is crucial and the bare minimum. But it cannot sustain the weight of all our emancipatory desires. We must be clear about its limits. Consent, agreement to sex, should not be conflated with sexual desire, enjoyment, or enthusiasm. Not because we should be resigned to bad sex, but precisely because we should not be. That women experience so much misery-making sex is a profoundly social and political issue, and consent cannot solve it for us.
For more Guardian long reads in text and a selection in audio, go to theguardian.com/longread or find us on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/theguardianlongread.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.